Welcome to The Indigenous Approach, a podcast where we examine the role of the nation's premier partnership force across the competition continuum, from cooperation to conflict and everything in between.
In this episode, Colonel Jamie Riesberg, the command surgeon, sits down with Major General John Brennan, Command Sergeant Major Ted Munter, Colonel Brian O'Leary, and Lieutenant Colonel Chris Ford to discuss mental health, how it impacts the force, and the importance of receiving help.
All right. Welcome to another edition of the Indigenous Approach. With us today, we have the honor of having our command team, or part of our command team here, Major General Brennan and Command Sergeant Major Munter. So, gentlemen, thanks for joining us. In addition, we have Colonel O'Leary, our command psychologist, and we also have Colonel Ford, our command senior judge advocate. So, gentlemen, thanks for being here. Topic of today's discussion is one that has been near and dear to the hearts of many of our folks as they've relayed some of these concerns through social media and up and down the chain of command. And that is, we're transitioning. We're getting out of the war in Afghanistan. There's a lot going on. We also acknowledge that 18 years of war has had some significant health effects on our folks, everything from TBI and BLAST to PTSD to just general all-around irritability, anger, all the frustrations that come and go with war. But now we're adding on top of that, we're transitioning. The Army is transitioning. Our national defense strategy is moving forward. And so now there's even a little bit of uncertainty added into that. So it's a time. It's a time of transition for our formation. But like all things we do in special operations, we're going to embrace that challenge. And so we want to have a discussion today about that perspective. So any thoughts on that as we get started?
Absolutely. So as we transition to great power competition, we're not saying that we're never going to go back to war again. Obviously, we want to keep the threshold, as does China, Russia, and our near peer competitors. They want to keep the threshold below crisis and conflict. And so what that means for our formations is we have to have creative ways to compete against them and impose costs to keep it from getting to the threshold where no one in the world wants it to go. That said, our competitors are going to employ surrogates across the globe to try to impose costs on us. And we have to be ready to respond to that. The nation needs us to do that. We have to compete in every domain all the time. And it is a daunting task, but we're ideally suited at 1st Special Forces Command and across our CSUs with the global footprint to do that.
Thank you, sir. CSM, any thoughts on that one?
It is a difficult time. Combat rotations are easy, you know, 6 months on, 6 months off, deploy, prepare to deploy. And a lot of times you have real measurable effects with your actions. Whereas with great power competition, those effects may seem unnoticed or have a much longer burn. But guys still need to understand their value to the organization and what they are doing for this command and on behalf of the nation. It does have a significant impact. You just don't see it day in and day out like you do in combat.
It's not as gratifying as CT, but you're planting seeds that will make the oak grow into something much stronger for the nation. You don't get immediate return on investment. Obviously, killing terrorists, you get immediate return with that, but when you develop a partner who can push back China in a certain area, whether financially, physically, or in the information space, that is equally gratifying, and it does help in the interest of national security. Folks are understandably feel like we're abandoning partners, and that's a natural thing. We've done this before, unfortunately. Policies change. We are ultimately a tool for political use in the DOD. So understanding why we're doing things is what leaders at all echelons have to explain to their folks. So we've had 20 years in Afghanistan. They're at a point where they should be standing on their own.
That's great, sir. And as we think about transition, one of the opportunities that we've seen as a staff is, as Sergeant Major mentioned, we're going from this very rapid op tempo, deploy, refit, and get right back into the game, to now we have a chance for folks to actually repair, to come home to restitute, repair, get to know their families. There's actually time now, aside from our previously programmed dwell time, to really do some self-care, do some family care. And for some folks, that's difficult because now they're going from a very fast-paced operation in the special operations world to, all right, now I'm just doing a JSET. And I say just a JSET, that still has massive strategic implications. But they've got time now to engage and get after some of the things that have been accumulating for the last 15 years or 10 years with combat tours. So I think we all message, hey, get the help if you need it. Take a moment to reflect, take that knee. But one of the terms we've heard recently, and I'd love your thoughts on, is depot level maintenance. So all of our pacing items in the Army, all of our weapon systems, you have a standard PMCS, which is the quick, hey, let's knock the dust off, make sure it's good to go. But we've also got depot level maintenance where every 5 years or 3 years, you take a step back, you pull that truck or that weapon off the line, and you really do some deep level maintenance. Is that a valid construct for our people? And is now a time that we can take advantage of that?
I think absolutely. So everyone reacts to stress differently. Everyone has a different tolerance. Some people are not affected by continuous combat rotations. Other people are scarred from only one. But it's up to us as leaders to identify the folks that need help and when they need it, as well as their mates to their left and their right. So those are the first sensors in the network that would help us out when we need to take someone offline for that depot level maintenance. Some people self-actualize. Some people, by the time they figure it out, it's too late. They've already committed a crime, or they've ruined a marriage, or they're now a substance abuser, and we can't help them left of the boom. So now we're into the punitive realm, which, is regulated by DOD, unfortunately.
Sir, thank you for that. That's, sadly, this is something that we want to address on the podcast today. And that is, some of these antecedents for criminal behavior or misconduct. And we've heard time and time again, this is why I'm fortunate to have some of our special staff here, our command psychologist and our SJA. We hear time and time again as a defense, well, I've been through a lot. I've been in combat. And essentially, almost, it wasn't me doing that. It was the PTSD doing that. So for our experts here, is that a valid defense? Is this okay to blame misconduct or bad behavior on a lot of this accumulated stress?
From a psychological point of view, and it comes down to competence. Are you competent? Do you understand the difference between right and wrong? And there's only three diagnoses that cause this, and you don't want any one of these three. Basically, psychosis, schizophrenia, bipolar and being manic, or having a TBI and becoming mentally retarded. And so, to be honest with you, when the JAG sends you to my office for the evaluation to determine, are you competent to stand trial? If you found my office on your own, the answer is you're probably competent. So while we understand what everyone's been through, it is not a excuse or defense for misconduct.
And from a legal perspective, not to diminish those conditions that people are suffering from, but you're absolutely right, Colonel O'Leary. It's not a legal defense. And in my 18 years in the JAG Corps, I have seen exactly one case where the soldier was found to be not mentally competent at the time of the trial. And as you described, I mean, he was psychotic at the time. It's an extraordinarily rare thing. And it just simply put is not a defense to misconduct.
And unfortunately, the way, we cope is often with substance abuse, and which, to be honest with you, it works great in the short term. I mean, it hits the GABA receptors. It's basically like taking a Xanax. Xanax is a six-pack and a pill. It works in the short term. The long term, though, is you can develop a substance disorder. You can destroy relationships. Eventually, you destroy your body. And mostly what we find is people don't do misconduct because of PTSD. It's the substances that they're trying to self-medicate with, and they're the wrong substances.
Okay. So with that thought in mind, what do we see as the role of our teammates in engaging this early and hopefully preventing going down the road of misconduct?
Well, we all owe it to each other to identify those symptoms. If your teammate's not acting right, or you can see the train wreck coming with too much drinking, potentially failed relationships, it's a red flag that needs to be addressed. So politely suggesting that someone seek help, there's nothing wrong with that. And then if it gets to the point where it's counter to good order and discipline, that's when you have to bring it to your chain of command. I hold every, you know, individual responsible. If they fail to do that, they're part of the problem, not part of the solution.
And that starts down at the detachment level. The pacing item for this regiment are our team and detachment sergeants. And in order to build high functional, cohesive teams, you need to know your soldiers and you need to know their families in and out. If you don't know your soldiers and their families, you're less able to identify and address those issues early on and mitigate them. Mm.
This reminds me of Sergeant Major of the Army Grinston's program, My Squad, where exactly like you just said, CSM, know your people at that team level so that you do know when things are getting off the rails. So you do understand what they're going through. Personal life happens, right? We all go through stuff. Everybody listening to this podcast right now is working through something. But you have teammates that are there that care and want to help shoulder that burden with you.
Yes, sir. Exactly right. In fact, the Sergeant Major of the Army actually referenced Special Forces ODAs for the purpose of This Is My Squad initiative. He wanted a more cohesive, disciplined unit that replicated the strong leadership found on SFODAs.
I think this is anecdotal, but intrusive leadership together with and knowing your teammates probably would almost drive me out of business from a military justice perspective. But I think, and I'll defer to the doctors here, but I think it's not only intrusive leadership and knowing your teammates and understanding when they're having issues, but it's knowing what resources to seek when you identify those issues and not trying to take care of them yourself, maybe. We have lots of professionals in an organization, two of them right here, that provide the services to us at a world-class level. Is that fair?
Absolutely. So on that point, Colonel Ford, so General Brennan mentioned a couple of those thresholds that people are going to cross where obviously you're going to involve the chain of command. You know, misconduct, legal, illegal actions, immoral actions, right? That's gonna force a leader to involve the chain of command. But what are some of the things that before that happens where you would encourage someone to seek help or seek professional guidance, maybe on behalf of a friend or even escorting them to someone else? So General Brennan mentioned one of them that comes to mind all the time, failed relationships, family difficulty. We have great resources with the Military Family Life Consultants, the MFLICs. There's a lot of resources at the garrison level, and then we have our POTF resources through the Human Performance Program that can help with a lot of that stuff. But as you think about the idea that comes to mind for me is the barracks lawyer, right? The smart guy that reads the regulation and looks in between. How do we counter that person? How do we seek good legal counsel prior to a teammate getting in trouble?
Well, I think, as you point out, it's identifying the issues early on and seeking the professional resources quickly. Domestic issues at home tend to be a recurring issue. Alcohol abuse, substance abuse tends to be a recurring issue. We've had a number of incidents and reports of steroid abuse and steroid use, which I think is probably more common than we recognize. And I think all these things could be addressed by teammates and, going to your teammate, identifying the problem on their behalf sometimes, or helping them identify it for themselves and seeking the assistance, getting help before they do something illegal, immoral, or unethical. Because once they've done that, as we mentioned earlier, that their associated behavioral health issues aren't an excuse for what they've done. So it's always best to address the problems early on, get the help they need, rather than having to address the fallout of what they've done.
Great point. One of the things we hear all the time is, I didn't come forward, I didn't seek help because I was worried it was going to impact my career. My clearance was going to get pulled or suspended. It was going to impact my ability to deploy on this next operation, go on this JSET. I didn't want to get pulled off the team. That's why I didn't go get help. What do you think about that?
I have two thoughts on this. One on security clearances. As I mentioned before, there's actually only two diagnoses that will automatically pull your security clearance. 2 years ago is the most recent. I think we adjudicated almost 600,000 security clearances, and less than 50 were pulled for psych reasons. That said, the behaviors people exhibited because of untreated PTSD, TBIs, substance abuse, that definitely will impact your clearance. If you hit your wife, if you get a DUI, you start failing at work, that's going to impact that's going to impact it. Another thought on this is we were talking about at what stage should you intervene. And typically, the last thing we see is occupational failure occupationally. By the time we get to that state, someone's way far along. When we see people start damaging relationships, especially their family and friends, or they start engaging high-risk behavior, those are things that as professionals and leaders, we may not see as well. And so that is why it comes down to the squad and having those hard conversations with your brothers and sisters.
If I could just emphasize the point about the security clearances. So between 2012 and 2018, DODCAF adjudicated 2.3 million security clearances. And of those 2.3 million, only 12 were lost as a result of mental health issues. So that's 0.005%, which by my math is about 10 times you're more 10 times more likely to be hit by lightning in your lifetime than you are to have your clearance revoked for mental health reasons. So extraordinarily unlikely. But what is very, very likely is if you commit a crime, that will result in punitive action. It will result in adverse administrative action. It will result in security clearance suspensions, revocations. And that's an absolute certainty.
And that goes with the key word I heard from you, Dr. O'Leary, which is untreated PTSD. So the ability to come forward, seek treatment, and work through those issues prevents you from ending up on a bad legal path. So that's certainly, we want to drive that home.
And this is very much a leadership issue, is not stigmatizing people that step forward to get help and giving them the time and space to get it. That's key.
So let's talk about that. I think one of the challenges we've heard from the ground level is it's hard to find time. I acknowledge that in the middle of combat operations, we were pushing hard and fast. But we're still hearing that now. The training calendars are chock full for a guy to take a knee to go get, you know, therapy with a counselor 3-4 hours a week. That 3 or 4 hours, that's a lot. That's a lot of time away from the team. And that may actually impact their ability to function on the team. How do we get through that? How do we navigate that?
I think we have to look at it from a different lens. Nobody bats an eye when they have to have surgery for a meniscus tear or a rotator cuff tear, or have sitting group CSM that just had a knee replacement and was on convalescent leave for 30 days. Nobody questions that. So why would anybody question wanting to be more productive member of that element, more efficient at my job because I'm doing the things I need to do to take care of myself, to be both mentally and physically sound.
And I think the further left of the issue you get, the less time you have to devote on a weekly basis to the treatment. So if you wait till it gets too far off the rails, now you're talking inpatient treatment potentially. So that's a lot of time away from the team. And you will miss deployments and you will miss training events that you would otherwise want to attend. So I think incorporating, it's just like physical training. You got to have mental training. I think every gym we've been to has a brain gym in it. The folks that man that have some skills that translate pretty well into, hey, you're a little slow on your reaction time today. Why don't you come talk to me after you're done working out? So, I mean, making it accessible where you don't have to go to a specific place that everybody knows you're going to see the psych, and embedding resiliency into training events, really, I think is hugely important.
We heard one of our cognitive performances at one of the groups often say, hey, if a guy's shooting's off, the very next question I ask him is, how are things at home? Because typically what we find, and back me up on this, Colonel O'Leary, is guys are devoting so much mental energy to the emotional stress or turmoil at home, the struggles with the family, that they can't focus on the range. And they're pulling shots, they're going wide. So there's a real impact to their ability to accomplish the mission when they're devoting all this mental energy to these drainage things. Mm-hmm.
And it can start off with, you know, just simply not getting enough sleep. So if you're getting less than, what, 4 hours of sleep a night, it's like you're drinking a six-pack during the day. So I don't want a drunk running through my – working in my office. So if you're not getting sleep, that's the first indicator you might need to talk to somebody.
And it's not just how much sleep, it's productive sleep. So a lot of people can run on 4 hours. And if you wake up feeling refreshed, I mean, you might be bipolar, but that's okay. But it's if you sleep 10 hours a night, and you are not feeling rested 5 minutes after you wake up, there's something going on with your sleep. You need to get that checked out. Everyone's different. Some people go on six, some people need 10. But if you are not waking up feeling refreshed, something's involved in that. And the number one cause across our formation, I'll be honest with you, a lot of people, you know, have a couple drinks to go to sleep. And that's a depressant. Unfortunately, when it's metabolized by the liver, two of the byproducts are stimulants. So I usually ask when people come in, you know, I'm like, well, you're probably waking up about 4 hours later, right? Oh yeah, how do you know, doc? Well, you're having a couple too many drinks. So if you just try it, 10 days without drinking and see what that does for your sleep. You may be very surprised.
It's a good challenge for all of us there. Appreciate that one. So one of the things we've thrown out before is that leaders at all levels, and this goes down to the team level, need a mentor. They need peers that surround them and that they can commiserate and collaborate with. But they also need mentees, people that they're investing in as junior soldiers. The NCO Corps has done this well for years. But I think oftentimes as officers, we sort of excuse ourselves from that. How are we doing with that? Do we have good mentors and peer relationships where we're supporting each other?
I think we do, but it can always be better. It's not as formal. And I think the Army Talent Management Task Force is getting after that to assign mentors to folks. And then, you know, it starts at really the West Point Service Academy / ROTC detachment level. People start that process earlier. So mentors, you know, everybody growing up, you never want to disappoint your father. It's kind of the same thing if you got a mentor that if you do something stupid, you know, someone who is in a position of authority, who you respect is going to be disappointed. It'll disincline you to do something stupid.
And mentors are often capable of having harder conversations because they know you and have a relationship with you and are likely to call you out on your behavior when, you know, have those uncomfortable conversations. And Dr. Riesberg, the other day, I'm stealing this, you know, identify who's your mentor and who do you mentee? And with our veteran suicide rates, just because you leave the Army doesn't mean that you can't still reach into the ranks and still mentor within because of those relationships. Dr. O'Leary at First Special Forces Command is some guy. So it doesn't matter. It's the people that you served with, that you went down range with, one up, one down. That is what's going to solve this problem.
Absolutely right. Mentorship should be lifelong, period.
This is the lifeblood of what we do as professionals. I've heard the word professional is described as a contract with society. Our nation entrusts us to be the nation's most agile elite warriors at the leading edge of ambiguous environments. That requires us to be on our A game all the time. The only way I know I can do that is when people that I know and trust come to me and say, hey, you're a little bit off today. What's going on? And I can decompress, unpack with them a little bit, and then get right back onto the problems that we need to solve. Because those are wicked, complex problems. We need cognitive warriors. And if we're wasting time, you know, chasing after, you know, pills, bottles, whatever, we're losing out on really what the nation trusts us to do as professionals.
And we have had some success stories with folks heading off suicides, lots of them, more than I ever thought was out there. Everything from neighbors, friends, peers, superiors, spouses, family members. We've had FRSAs save people's lives. So pretty important because we are seeing a trend in, unfortunately, violent misconduct across the formation over really since the holidays. A lot of it's been, I think, COVID has played into this with just added stressors to families. If you're at home with the kids all day long, it changes dynamics in people's lives. So people don't react well to change sometimes. And, you know, I think the constant cycle of different COVID restrictions coming on, going off, and different Army processes we've had with ROM. We've had different, you know, constantly changing guidance. I think that has played into this somewhat. But, you know, gun-related violence is something we had one or two instances all of, you know, the year before COVID, and now we're getting into some very uncomfortable numbers with shootings, murder, suicides. It's been alarming. So, and all those things, all those events, you can trace back to at the very start, some sort of behavioral health issue that was not treated.
It would be interesting to go back retrospectively and ask, what if a leader had stepped in, you know, with those folks early on And it may not have taken a full program. They might not have even had to go visit Colonel O'Leary, you know, and sit on the couch and spill their feelings. But it may be just a leader getting engaged and saying, hey, what's going on at home? How do we assess that we're doing on that as a culture in our enterprise? Do we think, you know, I'm thinking back to General Nagata, Lieutenant General Retired Nagata's podcast, I think it was 2 weeks ago, where he said, culture eats strategy for breakfast. How is our culture? Do we feel like we're heading the right direction with that?
Very slowly. Yes, sir. Obviously, we're clearly not there yet. We need to become a culture that views seeking help as a sign of strength and fortitude, and a culture that inherently understands that reaching out and asking for help is a challenge for most soldiers. But we also need to be one that embraces that challenge, just like we did when we volunteered to go to an assessment or selection, or we do every single day since arriving to, you know, your group or First Special Forces Command. And then we have to have leaders and peers that have the courage to look somebody in the eye and ask them, are you okay? What's going on? Have those hard discussions, because maybe it's just a discussion that changes the guy's view, changes the behavior.
A personal reflection, thank you, CSM, was a group commander that we'll leave unnamed on this, had the staff, and he said in front of all the staff, hey, I have made it a habit in my last 5 years to just go in, talk to someone, and decompress a little bit, talk about my marriage, talk about what's going on. And he said, I'm not ashamed to admit that I go and see behavioral health. And I encourage all of you to do the same. I will tell you, the effect that had on the staff was profound, because two or three people right after that conversation said, you know what, I'd been putting this off for a while. And if my group commander can do that, so can I. And I think in a way that endears the leader to the force as well, because it humanizes them and allows the formation to say, you know what, not perfect, but they're getting after it. They're trying to make themselves as best they can be.
And I think part of that is making the system work for the individual. So I think if you know you're going to go see the same person, you're comfortable with that person, you trust them, you're more willing to go to seek assistance. I know in my past, the same guy that screened me when I was going through a selection course, he's a guy I could turn to right down the hall and go, hey, doc, I'm not feeling good. Or, you know, I'm having this issue with sleep or whatever. And I knew him, so I trusted him. And I think that trust plays a huge part of it. If folks, they see the roulette wheel of different care providers, that's going to dissuade them from going back.
Sir, I want to thank you for bringing that up, because we want to be transparent on this podcast. We're not about blowing smoke. And I will tell you, as a military provider, I am oftentimes frustrated by some of the challenges that our folks have to access care. Our own Command Chief Warrant Officer Granowski is not here today, but he has a vignette from that just 2 weeks ago, where he was helping a service member and experienced some barriers to care. We are committed to fighting those barriers, but what I want to encourage anybody listening to this that is entertaining the idea of seeking help, persist, continue, push. It's worth it. You're worth it. Your family's worth it. We can't do this without you. And so be patient, be persistent. Sometimes our system is not the easiest, but when you do persist and you are able to get through, that keeps you off the misconduct list. That keeps you going, and after our nation's complex problems.
Yes, sir. We have numerous options out there. The military option is not the only one. If we can't get you in someplace to get you the help that you need, we'll figure out where to get you and get you that help that you need.
CSM, thank you. And that I can't say that any better. If you come to, and I can safely speak for the people at this table as our command team and our special staff, we will find an answer. I've watched Colonel Ford do this very effectively. If he doesn't know the answer, he is a bulldog until he finds it. So when our folks come forward, that's our sacred oath to them, right? Is that when you come forward for help and you need help and you're honestly seeking help, we will endeavor to do that. And I think that's a challenge I throw out to myself daily. Have I done everything in my power to make this as functional as possible for our folks to get the help they need? So that's a great point, CSM. there's a lot of other resources out there. Military OneSource is a great resource, right? That allows you to access completely off the record behavioral health care. None of that touches your record, allows you to call, get up to 10 visits of free care coordinated through an outside organization. Our own internal ranks, we have embedded behavioral health homes that provide great care. Your human performance teams are great folks to start with if you don't know where to go. And they all have taken that oath and commitment seriously too. If they can't find the answer, they will find someone who can. So everybody within our formation is all about this. We know there's challenges to the access to care, but we will find a way.
We've got a lot of great chaplains out there who are excellent as well.
Thank you. That's another person that I've never heard no from. Our chaplains are masters of finding a way to yes and facilitating whatever that family needs. And we haven't even touched on some of the other ancillary services, benevolence, our family programs. We have so much. Sometimes it's overwhelming to just think about all the resources we have. But all of that to say, as a leader, my challenge to myself is learn something about one of these organizations each week so that I know I can better refer people. But I challenge our leaders, even at the ODA levels, consider what are some of those things in your community that are working well. And each of our garrisons have different programs, different community successes. We had Jeff Strecker on a couple weeks ago. Great podcast for those who haven't had a chance to listen to that. Black Hawk Down tells it from his perspective as an E6 squad leader on the ground, losing his guys, and what the journey through despair and coming back around and now becoming just an amazing chaplain and leader. But he said some of his peers did not do so well after that event. And so he, great podcast on how to take your grief and the challenges that we face in the uniform and channel that into doing something amazing and good. We're going to have some more stories of challenge, struggle, and victory from some of our E7s and E8s. We're just great success stories, like you mentioned, sir, where people get involved, they engage, they help a brother or a sister out, and they overcome and they're stronger for it. And they've got a tremendous experience and story to share. So stay tuned for those episodes as we dig into some of the depth on our bench with our amazing warriors.
This has been The Indigenous Approach. We hope you have enjoyed this episode. Follow us on social media. And if you have suggestions for topics or guests, send us a message. Thank you for listening.